UEG Talks, gastroenterology to go. Welcome to our GI podcast. Listen for fresh insights and perspectives in science, education, and professional development.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this special episode of the UEG Talks, covering the best of the UEG week in Copenhagen. I'm Pradeep Mundry, and I'm your host today. I'm really, really excited to announce, to welcome Julia Miley, the chair of the UEG Scientific Committee, who's joined me in co-hosting this very special episode. Welcome, Julia.
Thank you, Pradeep.
So in this episode, we are covering the highlights and the best of endoscopy at UEG Week. Definitely my favorite international conference. Endoscopy lately has challenged the conventional norms with what is possible to do with a few fingers and some controls outside the human body. When I talk to my friends, they're fascinated to know how we can remove a 10-centimeter tumor from a working space of 2.8 millimeter. Of course, I'm talking about the gastroscope here. Such advancements would not be possible without scientific conferences such as UEG Week, ESGE. And such conferences provide the platform to learn, to improve, to collaborate, and get some amazing ideas to make such innovation happen. And the UEG Week in Copenhagen last week, 2 weeks ago, some amazing new science was presented, and some new ways of doing some older procedures were demonstrated. And some big practice-changing science was also presented. I was well and truly impressed. So I would request my co-host, Julia, to introduce, do the honors of introducing the guest today to talk about this.
Well, it's my great pleasure to introduce Professor Cesare Hassan, who's a dear member of the SciComm Committee of UEG. And he also is the mastermind behind the postgraduate course this year. Cesare, I'm really thankful for all your help in preparing UEG Week in Copenhagen. But in your real life, if you're not working for me, you're an associate professor at the Humanitas University in Milan, a gastroenterologist by training, and right now president-elect of ESGE, so the European Society of Gastrointestinal Endoscopy. You've previously been the treasurer of ESGE and also the chair of the guideline committee. And your special interest in endoscopy is artificial intelligence. So I'm pretty sure that we're going to kick off this meeting without knowing with an artificial intelligent abstract from UEG, where I really know that there had been a lot. So what was the most groundbreaking paper for you, Cesare, in Copenhagen?
Thanks, Julia, for your nice words. And I agree with you that the endoscopy community sent an impressive number of very good abstract to UEG 2023. And honestly, it was difficult for us to select a very few of the best abstract, Julia. But your leadership in the cycle helped me because it was all of us to select one abstract on artificial intelligence as one of the best abstract for this year. Not unexpectedly, Julia, this is an abstract on artificial intelligence in colonoscopy because there are on the market more than five AI for colonoscopy, and people want to know the actual efficacy of these devices. So the first highlight that we select is a multicenter study led by Peter Sinonquel from the group of Ralph Bishop in Leuven University, who performed an original study methodology. Instead of doing the typical randomization between AI and not AI, he put, while I was doing a colonoscopy, a second observer close to me who was looking at the second screen with artificial intelligence. And anytime I was missing a polyp, he was telling me, look, you are missing a polyp. And then I went back and I found hopefully the polyp. I really like this methodology because I feel it is more trusty, and it is in the same patient. This is an intra-patient study. It is not an inter-patient study. And in fact, Peter Sinonquel showed that the additional yield of adenoma detected by AI is only 4%. And this, Julia, is 6 times less than what estimated by randomized trial that we know can be biased. So I like this study, Julia, because it shows that a rigorous study methodology is essential to estimate realistically the benefit of a technique.
Cesare, I totally agree. And to be honest, I was also very surprised by the abstract of Alexander Han, and you might want to comment on that, where he showed that you can actually, by do-it-yourself or DIY, manufacture your own artificial intelligence device by just going to Media Market and buy the technology and a nice computer and comparing his own built device, which cost you about 100 euros, with all the technologies available on the market, showed equivalent results. So do you think we really need to invest a lot in these AI systems?
Yeah, this is a very good point, Julia. And I also pay tribute to Alexander for having done what, honestly speaking, companies would never ever have liked to do. I still remember that, I don't know, the first randomized trial between different interferon or different anti-TNF came very late. So this in artificial intelligence, thanks to Alexander, came early and came from an independent center. And I feel this is very informative for the endoscopy community because it shows that there is a substantial equivalence, at least in terms of sensitivity, of computer-aided detection. And also, when a guideline that are expected at the end of this year will come out, this will somewhat reassure that most of the computer-aided polyp system available on the market will reach the benefit recommended by the guideline group.
Looking forward to read that.
Yeah, it's coming.
Cesare, moving on to next. I was wondering if there's anything that was presented that would challenge or change our clinical practice imminently that we or that our listeners can take home and start practicing pretty much straight away. Was there any science or any new abstracts that were presented that we can adapt straight away in clinical practice?
Yes, Pradeep. We had an extensive submission of abstract in the field of advanced imaging for advanced colorectal lesion. And this was not unexpected because endoscopic submucosal dissection for colorectal lesion is taking place in Western countries. Helmut Messmann, Pradeep Bhandari, Alessandro Ripicci showed that only here in Europe we can have very good outcome with ESD, not only for rectal, but also for colorectal lesion. Thus, advanced imaging to stratify the risk and to orientate the treatment is of pivotal importance. In this case, I want to pay tribute to David Tate, who is an amazing UK endoscopist who spent a good part of his training in Australia before joining Belgium. And David is extremely good, not only in creating, but in validating training system. And in particular, in his abstract, he validated a training system based on six somewhat easy endoscopic features for the presence of an already invasive and deep polyp cancer. And we are talking about the six blink features, that is fold deformation, extra redness, depression, chicken skin mucosa, ulceration, spontaneous bleeding. And David showed that by performing such a system, the sensitivity for the detection of a deep invasive cancer substantially increased amongst a varied population of endoscopy. So this PREDIP is somewhat easy to do. It is based only on 20 overview images of colorectal polyp. It is extremely effective, but let me say PREDIP is clinically relevant. And this is what we want from medical intervention.
Yeah, Cesare, that's well put. I think one of the common problems that I see is the polyps that are referred for advanced therapy, they're inappropriately referred. So either they're already advanced tumors, or even the benign lesions are sometimes called malignant by other endoscopists. And having some sort of a simple clinical practice videos and images to use to predict advanced neoplasia would really help us, I think. And I hope David can share the video, because he did. I did go to that session, and I hope David can share the video to share on the UEG education website. That would make a big difference for clinical practice, I think.
I'm pretty confident. Pradeep, let me cite just very briefly one episode by Japan on the possibility to use advanced endoscopy to predict the risk of advanced histology in small colorectal polyps. First, I want to pay tribute to Japanese endoscopists, because they massively come to UEG, and their participation in endoscopy session is always somewhat enlightening, because of their ability to classify the risk of cancer in early lesion is amazing. In this case, they show that even in a small polyp, you can identify advanced neoplasia. And this is very important for the reset and discard strategy. I'm not sure that European endoscopists will have 30 or 40 minutes of time to spend in front of each small polyp. But I'm pretty confident Japanese endoscopists are opening the way for artificial intelligence to predict the risk of advanced neoplasia in a small polyp. And this will allow us to stratify polyp that can be reset and discarded, or that should be reset and sent to histology. So, albeit a bit in the long way, I feel that this abstract is in the long term a game changer, and it is a very nice job from our Japanese friends.
Yeah, I call it these things as gut feeling. Sometimes I say, yeah, polyp looks very advanced, and these guys have kind of structured it and sort of made given the features that would kind of predict my gut feeling.
So, moving on in our UEG talks, and if you recollect all your experiences from UEG Week in Copenhagen, which of these abstracts or talks would definitely change your existing standard treatments or paradigms? Anything you can remember?
Yeah, Julia. So I guess that we also appreciated the big input from the Hong Kong University, in particular by one of his leaders, Philip Q, in UEG. And from this university came a very somewhat clinically relevant study on the risk of bleeding according to the timing of interruption of anticoagulant treatment before a high bleeding risk endoscopic procedure. Let me be straightforward, Julia. Usually, we stop DOAC 48 or even more hours before high-risk endoscopic procedure. However, during this 48 hour, patients are at risk of a thromboembolic event. And I guess that each of us had, in their own clinic, patients who had a severe thromboembolic episode during this time. Thus, the Hong Kong team has been able to address the pharmacokinetic of the DOAC in the period before the endoscopy procedure in order to identify those patients who have an enough efficient kidney clearance to stop the treatment only 24 hours before. This would minimize the window of harm for a thromboembolic event. This is something, Julia, that I would like to have immediately in my clinical practice, because I never feel somewhat reassured to stop thromboembolic, to stop a DOAC in a person at high risk of thromboembolic event. I don't know if you agree with that.
I can totally agree with that. And I absolutely understand that that is a really important contribution to our clinical practice. The question which comes to my mind immediately is, I mean, yes, we now know when to stop it, but the much harder decision is when to restart it. And I mean, that very much depends on the procedure you've actually done. But do you think we should also question this in future trials?
Absolutely, Julia. This is extremely relevant. Just an anecdotal example. Yesterday, it came to my clinic a patient who stopped DOAC 1 month ago because after a colonoscopy where there was a polyp not removed, he was recommended to stop DOAC before polypectomy. But then polypectomy was never planned, and this patient has been without anticoagulant for more than 2 months. So the restart of DOAC is extremely important. Unfortunately, we don't have somewhat clean data as a pharmacokinetic in the endoscopy field, but I agree with you that we should learn to stratify the bleeding risk of our stigmata specifically according to the time of restarting of the DOAC. So we are a bit in delay as compared with the pharmacokinetic of stopping rather than to restart. Yeah, this is a very good point.
Yeah, I mean, this is obviously because of the heterogeneity, but I can actually tell you from my experience last week that I had a patient who was 83 years old who got a sphincterotomy for cholangitis, and he bled because he was still hadn't been stopping his DOACs long enough, but we couldn't wait. And he replaced a FC ZEMS, and he came back now 12 weeks later, bleeding heavily, arterial bleeding from his papilla. So we didn't expect that. So I had to remove the SEMS without radiology and had to replace it after I clipped the papilla, which was quite strange because I thought 3 months later, that's just impossible. But this probably illustrates how little we know about the biology of bleeding. But we certainly need to stratify it there. As our cardiologists prescribe more and more DOACs for any indications.
Yeah, the unpredictability of the DOAC effect is in endoscopy a problem. They can anticipate that in the next year, probably to be terminated a randomized trial on colesnaring without and with the DOAC interruption. I'm pretty confident that it will be presented at our next OEG, so please come to see it.
Cesare, obviously you know most things in endoscopy. You know what happens in the endoscopy world with friends around you who you collaborate with. But was there something that, or something important that you didn't know what was new to you? Or is there any other science that you want to highlight that we have not covered so far?
Yeah, there is one very controversial paper that I would like to discuss with the worldwide leading expert like Julia on a Dutch multicenter randomized trial on endoscopic sphincterotomy to prevent pancreatitis after we put a metastent for a malignant biliary obstruction. So, Julia, I want to pay tribute to the author to include a very well-defined population. I feel this is something that we should recognize. This is an interim analysis, but I feel that the data are already very clear because they show that there is a not clinically relevant difference in the risk of pancreatitis between the two groups. We are talking about 17 and 21%, so it's not clinically relevant. And so the most likely conclusion is that the need of sphincterotomy is probably marginal in these patients. But again, I leave the interpretation of the result to you.
Well, I mean, I found this abstract really striking, and I also found the trial striking. Initially, when I read the heading, I thought they are really very brave. Because, I mean, if you think about the pathophysiology of acute pancreatitis going back 100 years, thinking about the OP hypothesis of duct obstruction, which actually leads to pancreatitis, then placing a fully covered metal stent without a sphincterotomy will immediately lead to the obstruction of the pancreatic duct, and that should consequently or consecutively lead to pancreatitis. So looking at the data, one can only think that the reason why not everybody gets rip-roaring pancreatitis is that you have a malignant mass in the pancreatic head, which is slowly growing, and all those patients already have pancreatic duct obstruction, and the organ has adapted to the situation and maybe even become atrophic. And that is the reason why we don't see a difference. The counter argument to this is the very high rate of post-ERCP pancreatitis. So one would expect a pancreatitis rate of, say, approximately 3 to 8%. But in this study, we see a post-ERCP pancreatitis rate of 17 to 21%. I mean, I totally agree that that always depends on how you define post-ERCP pancreatitis, and probably to not include or recruit too many patients in this trial, they probably used with respect to the Cotton criteria, also the milder forms of acute post-ERCP pancreatitis, and included it there. And this is why they have such a high number. So whether the number of pancreatitis cases is clinically relevant cannot really be read from the abstracts. And the only other explanation I have is that we are in the situation that with a p-value of below 0.05, we still have a considerably number, so one in every 20 studies, which is false positive or false negative for its outcome. And we have to await the final results and not only look at the interim analysis. So I found these abstracts striking, but to be honest, I'm not ready to change my clinical practice, and I will continue doing a sphincterotomy, especially as I learned my lessons from the balloon sphincteroplasty, which gives you a higher rate of post-ERCP pancreatitis.
Yeah, very good point, Julia. The result of one study should not immediately affect your clinical practice, but it should only be contextualized in it. For this reason, Julia, let me also add that this year was a bit special for endoscopy in UAG, because for the first time, we somewhat target the field of advance in clinical gastroenterology to endoscopy, and we had three outstanding sessions on the benefit that endoscopy gave to the community in the last 30 years. So we had an outstanding session on third space endoscopy, for instance. We had a session on quality endoscopy. We had a session on hepatobiliary. So I feel that this is the first year that endoscopy really entered as a clinical protagonist in UEG, and this was in the same day as the live transmission by Asburg, and all the room were very well attended, showing the attraction of endoscopy in the program.
I totally agree. I absolutely agree there. So that brings us to our next question. Is there anything that caught your eye on modification or changes to existing techniques that will either make them simpler, more effective, or even more cost-effective?
So the cost-effectiveness came in a nice debate in between Evelyn Decker and Matt Callagher from actually the breast screening experience on whether the artificial intelligence create overdiagnosis. I feel that the issue of a massive screening for early cancer will lead to a substantial implementation of a cost for overdiagnosis. Unfortunately, endoscopists seem to be somewhat neglected to this issue. But Matt Callagher really convinced the audience on the fact that most polyps will never develop to cancer. Probably most of squamous dysplasia will never become to cancer. The same in gastric and in the Barrett. So probably in the next year, Julia, we should be a bit more critical about what the actual benefit of a screening endoscopy is, because this creates a lot of anxiety in the population, a lot of resources. Waiting lists all over Europe are really a problem. And so overdiagnosis is something that we should learn from other medical fields. Endoscopy is not always something that you save the life of a patient because you remove a polyp or because you detect a Barrett.
I couldn't agree more. That's just absolutely true. Cesare, it has been a real pleasure talking to you, as always. And next UEG week, with respect to endoscopy, will be as good as this year because we will have the same program director. So thanks for joining us tonight and see you soon.
Thanks, Julia. I also join your invitation to everyone to attend next UEG, especially because the postgraduate course is completely updated and renewed with a new learning point, and it will be a fascinated curricula for all the gastroenterologists who in a short time want to gather all of the available information for their clinical practice. Thanks.
Thank you, Cesare. Thank you for so much. Thanks for listening to this episode, everyone. I hope it was fun and exciting. Cesare always gives an amazing insight into things, which I always appreciate. That we could cover a lot. There was so much more science, and the field of endoscopy was brilliant. So if our listeners want to go through the UEG platform, the virtual platform, to go through some of the abstracts, they can access those. So stay tuned and goodbye. Thank you.
Thank you.